I'm very pleased to be here today, and I'm going to talk about some work on lymphocytes. And so by way of introduction, let me say that the orchestrators of your adaptive immune response are a class of cells called T lymphocytes, or T cells, shown in this micrograph as this blue cell over here. And they have evolved to deal with pathogens that are no longer in your blood or mucosal surfaces, but have actually penetrated inside your cells. So specialized cells that are called antigen-presenting cells, this green cell over here, which harbor a pathogen, say a bacterium or a virus, will display molecular signatures of this pathogen on their surface. If a T cell recognizes those molecular signatures as being of foreign origin, then signal transduction occurs inside the cell, which then leads to gene transcription programs, gets the cell to start to divide, and then these cells go out into your many parts of your peripheral tissues and mounts an immune response in a variety of different ways, only one of which is that some kinds of T cells, if they encounter other cells displaying the same molecular markers of the pathogen, they can directly kill them by secreting products. So what are the molecular signatures of the pathogen that are displayed on the surface of this antigen-presenting cell? So if you have any virus or bacterium inside the cell, it will start to make proteins that its DNA codes for rather than yours. Then these foreign proteins are cut up into short peptide fragments by enzymes like proteases and peptidases inside these cells. And these peptide fragments are anywhere between 9 to 14 amino acids long, depending upon the type of T cell. So it is a short peptide fragment. And then in each one of your cells, there is a class of proteins coded for by the major histocompatibility gene complex. So that's why they're called MHC proteins. And in this cartoon inspired by X-ray crystallography, this is shown here as this green protein over here. And these guys have a groove at the top in which potentially they can bind one of these peptides that comes from the foreign protein. All of this happens inside your antigen-presenting cell, but ultimately this peptide MHC complex inserts through the cell membrane and displays itself on the surface, and that's the molecular flag of the pathogen. A peptide derived from foreign proteins bound to the MHC. When your T cell interacts with this antigen-presenting cell and this peptide MHC complex, it does so through a protein called the T cell receptor, usually called the TCR, and it's kind of interesting that this was first cloned independently by my collaborator Mark Davis and our first speaker, TACMAC, and many of these prizes that you allude to for TACMAC have come for the cloning of the TCR jointly with Mark. Anyway, one interesting aspect of this T cell receptor is that the genes that code for the T cell receptor are inherited from your parents, not as one whole gene, but as gene segments. And during the synthesis of each T cell, these gene segments stochastically recombine. And as a consequence, almost every T cell has a unique T cell receptor. So when we say that a given T cell recognizes a particular antigenic peptide, what we mean is that its TCR binds sufficiently strongly to this peptide MHC complex to enable a variety of different molecular signaling reactions to occur inside the cell. So over the last decade, I've been very interested in various aspects of T cell biology, and the central theme of our work has been to try and bring theory and computation together with complementary experiments, all carried out by collaborators who are immunologists at medical schools, with the hope of trying to use this synergy between theory and experiment to obtain mechanistic insights about a variety of different processes. And with the key assistance of these experimental collaborators, we've had some luck over the years in thinking about problems that range from molecular signaling to a T cell repertoire development and human disease. But only a very small part of this connects at all to cancer, and so I was very surprised to receive this invitation, and partly what piqued my interest. I didn't know that I worked on cancer, but what I will describe today to you is some work on molecular signaling that we've recently done that does have some connections, albeit tenuous, perhaps you will judge that to be the case, on cancer. It is also mathematically the most simplest things that I do. And so to the mathematicians, I apologize for the simplicity of the ideas that I will present in connection, but I thought I would talk about this because it does have some connection to cancer. So the problem I'm going to talk about is going to concern events downstream of what happens in the signaling cascade after T cell receptor binds to this peptide MHC complex. As you know, a number of biochemical reactions occur. We'll come back to some of the details a bit later. For the moment, let me simply note that these biochemical reactions often simply convert a protein from its inactive to active form, say, for example, by adding phosphate groups. And so one could look at various activated forms of downstream signaling molecules. And if you looked at a lymphocyte that is very weakly stimulated, say, for example, by binding to a peptide MHC that binds rather weakly to it, then for such weakly stimulated T cells, a number of active downstream signaling products in a population of cells will maintain some weak basal level of signaling. And that's illustrated here as a histogram. This is the number of cells, how many active signaling products do they have, and you see for weakly stimulated cells, you have some weak basal level of signaling. Now, let's say you progressively increase the strength of the stimulus to this T cell. Say, for example, by using peptide MHC ligands or the TCR that bind to it progressively more strongly. Then this population of cells could respond in one of two ways. One way is shown here in red, where as the stimulus increases, the entire population of cells moves the amount of active signaling products to higher levels. Such a sort of continuous response to a continuous change in the strength of the stimulus may be termed analog, if you like. Alternatively, the population of cells could respond such that over a threshold stimulus, which is fairly sharply defined, the population of cells could split into two subpopulations, one that has turned on very large amounts of the signaling components and one that still maintains basal level of signaling. Such an on-off response, if you like, could be termed digital in character. And about a couple of years ago, Ron Germain's lab made this serendipitous observation that T cells, in fact, do respond in this digital on-off fashion. So my talk today is largely focused on this. On what's the molecular machinery that enables T cells to exhibit such digital responses, and then some functional implications of our findings pertaining to that phenomena that I will describe. So the work I will describe is a very close collaboration with Art Weiss's lab at UCSF Medical School. And this work was led by two young guys in our labs. One was Jerome Roos in Art's lab, and the other was Jayajit Das in my lab. Both of these guys now have their own independent faculty positions. And in fact, Jayajit is kind of an interesting case because he's a physicist by training, a non-equilibrium statistical physicist who worked with me a number of years as a postdoc, and now has the position of a professor of pediatrics at Ohio State University. So it's kind of amusing, but anyway. So, and the work that I'll describe is largely published in these two publications last year. So when a T cell receptor engages a peptide MHC, a number of different biochemical transformations occur. And what I want to focus on today is one of the early events is that a protein called RAS-GRIP gets activated in a DAG-dependent way, which is another protein. RAS-GRIP is a guanine exchange factor. And what it does is that it catalytically activates or converts inactive GDP-bound RAS proteins to their active GTP-bound form. Active RAS has many, many downstream targets and therefore can start many different signaling pathways, and we've already heard a number of times this morning in the first two talks about how RAS is a well-known oncogene because uncontrolled activity of RAS can lead to all kinds of bad things happening. Now, lymphocytes have a second guanine exchange factor called SON7-less or SOS, which also converts GDP-bound RAS to its active form. And this particular enzyme, which converts RAS to its active form, has been studied with a great amount of diligence by the John Corey and Daphne Barsagni's group using both biochemistry as well as X-ray crystallography. And what they found was that SOS, here's the catalytic domain of SOS, and a little bit more of it, SOS has a catalytic site where it binds inactive GDP-bound RAS that distorts the molecule, it releases GDP, and then abundantly present GTP can quickly bind to this, and that's the catalytic way in which it converts RAS GDP to GTP. But they also found that this basal rate of RAS activation by SOS is very low, almost zero. But serendipitously, they discovered that there is another site on SOS which can also bind either RAS-GDP or RAS-GTP. So if RAS-GDP is bound at this site, this catalytic rate goes up modestly, about 5 times. But if the product of this catalysis, RAS-GTP, is bound at this allosteric site, or this other site, then this rate goes up almost 100 times. So you can see immediately that this module is subject to positive feedback regulation because the product of the catalysis bound to the allosteric pocket increases the catalytic rate by a huge amount. So we first wanted to see what the signaling module does by itself if it was in the test tube. It is not. As I've showed you, it's integrated in a more complex pathway, and we'll discuss how that integration works in just a few minutes. But first we want to just study what does this positive feedback possibly do. One can build a very simple model for this. The allosteric site of SOS can bind either RAS-GDP or GTP, and depending upon what's bound at the allosteric site, GDP to GTP reactions occur with different catalytic rates. And then there are, in T cells and other cells, RAS gaps and other GTPases that will convert RAS-GTP back to RAS-GDP, and these have been studied a lot by people like Whittinghofer and others in the context of lymphocytes. So we then asked, if we increase the stimulus, and in this trivial model, the increasing of the stimulus simply means more SOS targeted to the membrane, because that's what happens when you have a higher stimulus, more SOS goes to the membrane. If you have more SOS, how will that RAS-GTP amounts change, the active amounts of RAS? Of course, we all realize that this does not have a deterministic answer because we're talking about stochastic biochemical reactions, and therefore every cell will show different amounts of RAS-GTP because it depends on how many times each type of these reactions occurred. But nevertheless, let's pretend we want to first understand what the story is at the population level and try to understand what the most probable value of RAS-GTP or the concentration will be. So for this, one can write down very simple mean field differential equations to describe this. And as you all know, the parameters in this are the rate coefficients. So what was nice and why we studied the module by itself first is because John's lab had measured all of these rate parameters in this model, except that in one case they measured just the ratio of two parameters rather than the individual parameters. Nevertheless, what we were able to do for that case was vary the individual numbers of those two parameters that we didn't know exactly over factors of 20 while keeping the ratio the same, and we found the same qualitative behavior. Yeah. That means that we are ignoring all cell-to-cell fluctuations, and we are looking only at the average concentration in the population of cells. That's all. And later we will see that we will study the cell-to-cell variations because they are very important. Okay? Yeah, please do interrupt as time goes on if there are questions of the sort. So anyway, and what is that qualitative behavior that we see just for this very simple signaling module? We see that there's a bistability because of positive feedback regulation. That is, if we plot the amount of RAS-GTP concentration as a function of the amount of SOS targeted to the membrane or stimulus, at low stimuli levels, you see almost no RAS activity. At high stimuli levels, you see a lot of RAS activity. But for stimulus levels or doses between this point B and this point A, you see that the mathematics says that there are three possible solutions to these equations. And the two red states for any given situation are stable states, and they are separated by a manifold of these blue unstable states, and from the biology standpoint, the unstable states are simply one, so the slightest perturbation would take you away from them into one of the other two, and so in an actual experiment, you're almost highly unlikely to ever see these unstable points. Nevertheless, there are two stable solutions over a range of doses. So this then suggested to us that it is possible that this soft signaling module, because of this bistability, might lead to digital signaling, because once you exceed this dose B, because of stochastic effects, some cells will jump up to the high state and some cells will remain in the low state. So to test this idea, now you have to carry out solutions of the equations that characterize the signaling network, not in this average response kind of way, but you actually have to do it for each cell or each realization, carry out stochastic simulations, which solve the master equations. And there are many ways to solve these master equations. Most typically, people use the Gillespie simulation algorithm, and I will do a little bit of advertising here. One of my students has collaborated with a bunch of computer scientists, and we think the world's fastest Gillespie simulator, which can also do spatially explicit simulations. You can download it for free from our website, and if you have any questions, well, we are not experts at we've created a bit of a tutorial manual and all this kind of stuff, but we'll try to help you as much as we can if those are not clear, if one of you wants to use these kinds of tools. In any case, I didn't plan on saying that, but so what do you do with these Gillespie simulations? You run with the identical conditions, you run the simulation again and again, and each simulation for the biologist is like assaying a single cell, as you would do in a FACS experiment. And each time you measure the amount of RAS GTP, and then you plot the results as a histogram, much as you would plot the results of a FACS experiment. So now, of course, though, when you have the entire signaling network, we actually stop at RAS activation for reasons I'll point out in a few minutes. If you do the simulation of the signaling network, now there are many parameters that you don't know, so unlike when you were doing this little module. So if you look at that cell paper of ours last year, the web supplement is 132 pages long, and that is mostly because of all the parameter sensitivity studies that we did to see over what ranges of parameters do we see the behavior that we predict, because unless you do that, no experimentalist like Art will ever make all the efforts to test these ideas. So once in a while, very rarely, you get a very thoughtful referee who, rather than just tell you you're wrong, tells you to do things that actually make you understand the problem better. And one of the referees we got was indeed in that kind, and he said, okay, you've shown this enormous amount of insensitivity or robustness of your behavior to many, many wide ranges of the unknown parameters. Why is that? Try to make some simplified models of the network, do some analysis on it, and see what are the most important necessary conditions to get the behavior that you get, while the other things can be more sloppy in parameter space. So we did do that, and that's, again, published, so I won't go through that, but here were the three things we found that were the most important elements of getting the behavior that I'll show. One is that SAW should be subject to positive feedback regulation. We knew that. That's accurate. The other one, these RAS gaps that convert RAS GTP back to RAS GDP, that must happen in a catalytic fashion. In other words, mathematically, the kinetic equation must not be power law in character. That's not sufficient nonlinearity to let that happen. Again, from Wittinghofer's work, we know that that is true. And the third feature that is necessary for this behavior is this RAS grip, this other guanine exchange factor that I told you about. It must not be so active that it converts all the RAS GDP in the molecule to its active state before a SAW's feedback loop can get primed. And this we did not know when we started. So if you do these simulations and you pretend, these are simulations pretending that what you're doing is taking something called a Jurkat T cell into which you can transfect many different species, and you're transfecting in different amounts of the catalytic domain of SAW. And you see, this is a histogram, this is the number of cells, the amount of RAS GTP, and for low stimulus, so SAW's cat levels, you see that's some basal level of signaling. For very high, there's high level of signaling. And above a very sharply defined threshold, you see that this peak does not move, but rather a new peak begins to grow at that higher state. Yeah?
What are the units on the x-axis?
Molecules. Per cell. Yes, because in this case, we are actually stimulating very, very weakly in all these situations. So the amount of SAW targeted being transfected is not large. You'll see bigger numbers. Yeah, but that determines how much RAS gets made, because that's the only catalyst here. Okay, so. Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. And then there will not be. Then there will not be. Then there will not be. And I will show you experimental data now very so shortly. So, I mean, nothing will be left untested. So. And by the way, RAS molecules, the numbers we use are taken from estimates that we have of RAS molecules in lymphocytes. They are estimates. They are not well-known, exactly known numbers. But what we put in into the calculation is exactly what is known, and we vary it over factors of 10 to see whether there is sensitivity to it or not. Okay, so now you can do the exact same experiment, because what you can do is take a Jurcat T cell and transfect in different amounts of the catalytic domain of SOS. And what you see if you do that is that you get this same similar kind of behavior. However, there is a very important problem here. The problem is that because of the technical difficulty, you cannot do FACS experiments and measure RAS in individual cells without greatly overexpressing RAS, which is not how it is in the real cellular system. So what you see here is phospho-ERK, which is downstream of RAS. So you could argue that this RAS by stability and digital signaling that we predict has nothing to do with this, but this happens because of some feedback loop downstream RAS between RAS and phospho-ERK. So we spent 2 years trying to distinguish between those two possibilities, and I'll describe some work where we used the theory and computation to help design experiments that could try and distinguish between these possibilities. So the first thing that we saw is that if you carry out simulations where the second guanine exchange factor, RAS GRIP, is not present, then you see that the levels where you were seeing this second peak emerge, it's not there in these RAS GRIP deficient simulations. These are experiments with RAS GRIP deficient Jurcat T cells. You don't see it either. What the simulation said was this was because of the following. RAS GRIP is not subject to positive feedback regulation, and it makes the first RAS GTP molecules that then goes and primes SOS's feedback loop by binding to its allosteric pocket. So when you don't have RAS GRIP, then what happens is that it takes, SOS has to generate its own RAS GTP, which makes it less sensitive. So this then suggested that if you could do an experiment where you put in an exogenous form of RAS GTP, which can bind to SOS's allosteric pocket, then in these RAS GRIP deficient cells, at the same stimulus level, you should see the emergence of this peak. But very importantly, this exogenous RAS GTP has to have a second mutation so that it doesn't bind to downstream targets, in particular RAF, which is next to RAS in the RAS MAP kinase pathway. So your own got such a mutant, which has one mutation that does not let it bind to RAF, and is a constitutively active form of RAS GTP. And when you put that in, then in the same situation, you see the second peak emerge. But much more importantly, if he also then mutates SOS such that its allosteric pocket cannot bind RAS, then you see that this second peak gets inhibited. So at this point, you could still argue, though, that yes, digital signaling is predicated on SOS being present, but that's simply because SOS then makes a lot of RAS GTP, which primes some downstream feedback loop, because this experiment certainly does not preclude that. So how could we test for that? So the way to test for that is to look at these simulations. But here what we have done is we have simulated when we stimulate with a T-cell receptor simulation, and we stimulated very robustly, very strong peptide MHC binding ligand. And this is the time course of these histograms. And you see that the histogram moves through and goes here and goes through this double hump because of this bistable or digital character. And these are experiments with both the naive T cells as well as cell lines. All of them show the same sort of pattern. Now, the simulation showed that if you were somehow able to only activate T cells through the RAS GRIP pathway, somehow bypass SOS, then if you looked at this time course, you would see an analog or continuous motion of this peak, because that is not subject to positive feedback regulation. So this suggested that if we could stimulate a T cell very robustly through RAS GRIP pathway alone, such that RAS levels were the same, active RAS levels were the same as in a wild type system, then if the only role of SOS was to provide enough active RAS, then you should still see this bimodal distribution. In contrast, if you were able to stimulate through this RAS grip pathway alone robustly, and this pattern switched from this kind of going through a bimodal pattern to one that went like this, then we would say that SOS played a very important role in controlling this. Not to say other factors don't play a role, but this would be a dominant role. So here are the experiments which you can stimulate T cells through only the RAS grip pathway using a drug called PMA, and you see that the pattern of ERK phosphorylation switches to completely analog in character. This bimodal hump is gone. There are many other ways we have tried to test this. Let me mention that the membrane proximal B cell signaling machinery is very similar to T cells, but you can do something in B cells you cannot do in T cells. You can't make a genetic knockout mouse that is SOS minus minus and get any T cells out of it. They don't make it through development, as I'm describing just a minute why. But I won't describe why. I will come to development later on. But B cells do develop, and what you see is that you see a bimodal signaling pattern for wild-type B cells, but if you delete SOS, you lose that bimodal pattern of signaling. And here is the clean experiment because it's genetic mutation rather than drugs and so forth. Another way we can do it is to test whether digital signaling occurs at the RAS level. All of this is ERK, right? But indirectly, we might be able to test whether digital signaling occurs at the RAS level by doing population-level experiments, since we can't do the single-cell assays for RAS. And that is suggested by the fact that along with bistability should come hysteresis. That is to say, that if this is the average dose response curve, the one that you would see in a population of cells through a Western blot experiment, then as you increase the stimulus, you would follow along this red curve at the average population level, and only here would you see a sudden jump in the population of cells showing a lot. On the other hand, if you previously stimulated a cell and then started withdrawing stimulus, then you should not jump back here, but you should follow this curve back. That is, the dose response curve depends upon whether or not it was a previously stimulated cell or a naive cell. So this indicates the following, that if you were to put this level of dose, a weak dose, that does not stimulate previously unstimulated cells, a previously stimulated cell should show a high level of stimulation. Now, one thing we have to know is these are mammalian cells, and they have tonic signaling, so when you take stimulus away, things start turning down. Fast GTP levels start coming down, so forth and so on. So what we really can do is the experiment corresponding to these calculations. And the calculations are this. You first robustly stimulate RAS with a strong stimulus. RAS levels are high. Then you take the stimulus away, so RAS levels start to come down because of all these things that I just mentioned. And then you come back with a second weak stimulus that previously would not stimulate this cell, and you should see a robust jump back. If you wait longer, then you will jump back, but if you wait too long, you will not jump back. And why is that? That's because, let's say you stimulated the cell here, then during the rest period, RAS GTP levels are coming down, and what we know from this mathematical structure is that as long as this RAS GTP level after the rest exceeds the unstable point corresponding to the second weak stimulus, you will jump back to the upper one. If you really come below this, you will jump back to the lower one. So, Art and others were able to test this idea, again, with both T cells and B cells. In the interest of time, I'll show you only the B cell data. The T cell data you can see in the paper. In the B cell, you can stimulate a B cell with a plant lectin called cannabinoid A, and this is just Western blot for RAS, and you see robust RAS activation. Then you come in with a alpha MM, which is an inhibitor of cannabinoid A, and you see the signal starts to go down. You then come in with a second very weak alpha BCR cross-linking stimulus, which does not in control experiments show does not stimulate RAS activity, and you see robust RAS activation comes on. Notice, however, that the reason I'm showing this experiment and not the T-cell experiment is, again, because you can delete SOS genetically, and you do not see this hysteretic effect. Now, this may have, so the rest of my talk will all be about functional implications of these findings. So one functional implication of the short-term memory in T cells may be the following. So this hysteresis confers short-term memory of membrane proximal signaling events. And the experiments seem to suggest that the memory is about 10 minutes long. Okay? We cannot predict that because we do not know all the parameters. We can just say it exists. Okay? So these days, people can do some amazing experiments. The T cells interact with these antigen-presenting cells that I showed you earlier in your lymph nodes first. And these days, people can take a live mouse, anesthetize it, put into it T cells that are fluorescently labeled and antigen-presenting cells that are also fluorescently labeled and carry the foreign peptide MHC. And then you can image them live. And this is shown in this picture taken from our collaborator, Uli von Andrian's laboratory. So the green cells are the T cells. The red cells are the few antigen-presenting cells that are labeled with fluorescent tag. This is the high endothelial venule, and you see the T cells come out from there, and then they're interacting with these red cells. The black space is not empty. It's full of antigen-presenting cells that are not fluorescently labeled. So what people see is that, and by the way, you see they conduct random walk statistics. If you looked at the trajectories, there would be random walk statistics. And after some time, that depends upon the antigen dose, et cetera, these T cells will make long-standing contacts with each of these dendritic cells or antigen-presenting cells and so forth. So I'm not going to tell you this in detail, but in these two papers, we describe how we just analyzed the data that was coming out. We did no mechanistic studies. We just analyzed these data. And the data suggested that T cells were able somehow to integrate multiple interrupted signals, signals obtained from multiple interrupted encounters with these red antigen-presenting cells. At that time, we had no idea what the molecular machinery might be, but we suggest now that perhaps what is happening is that this hysteresis that goes on until the RAS level and ERK level may be responsible for maintaining knowledge that you just saw one, so quickly you can recognize weak antigen in the second time. But this has not been proven in vivo, because what you need for this is simultaneously doing this imaging as well as looking at the signaling at the same time. And this requires that you make a mouse that has a reporter for one of these signaling molecules that we talked about. It's something that Andre Shaw's lab is making, and we hope that this will be seen in vivo at some future time, but I can't say that we've seen it now. Okay, so I want to tell you two more implications before I quit. So every time you make a T cell, and I told you T cell has a specific T cell receptor, and all these T cells end up in your thymus, which is an organ right behind your sternum. And in this thymus is present peptide MHC molecules, where all the peptides are derived from various parts of your own proteome. And to exit the thymus and come out into your blood and become a part of your army of T cells, each baby T cell or thymocyte has to pass two examinations. One test is that it must bind at least one of the diverse self-peptides it sees weekly. And the other is that it must not bind any of the self-peptides it sees beyond a threshold higher strength than this weak binding to one. So the things I'm most interested in these days are the T-cell repertoire development and its connections to HIV and so forth and so on. But today I'll focus only on a signaling aspect of this. And that was motivated by some findings from Ed Palmer's lab at Basel a few years ago. What he did was he took the thymuses out of mice. This is a fetal thymic organ culture, and in these thymus, he would flood it with only one type of peptide, whatever he wanted to, and he had a T-cell, the OT1 T-cell line, which binds various peptides with different strengths. And then, depending upon which he put in, he would ask how many T-cells came out and became mature T-cells from this, okay? So he was going after what are the positive and negative selection thresholds. And this is plotted here on this axis. Are these various peptides ordered from the weakest binding to the TCR to the strongest binding to the TCR. And what you see is that as you increase the strength, more and more T cells come out. They mature in a graded fashion over a range of different stimulus strengths. And then once you hit a threshold, boom, you get negative selection, which is by binding too strongly and creating too much signal. And that is very sharply defined with this binding affinity of this ligand to the TCR and this one being separated by a factor of 1.2. So we think, based on our calculations, that this difference between the positive and negative selection thresholds, one being graded and one being very sharp, may have to do with this interplay of RAS grip and SOS in activating RAS. Because what we think is that when the stimulus is weak, signaling occurs largely through the RAS grip pathway. And as I just showed you, both experimentally and computationally, that is an analog response. But once you hit a threshold level, SOS's feedback loop gets engaged. You make a lot of RAS, therefore you make a lot of ERK, and large ERK activity is known to correlate with negative selection. And the sharpness comes from this positive feedback regulation of SOS. So why is it that weak signals or weak stimuli only lead to signaling through the RAS grip pathway? So our simulations suggest that this is because of a step that occurs prior to SOS, all this RAS activation business I was telling you about. There is a large signaling complex that's put together in a molecule called LAT. And LAT has four important tyrosines. Actually, it has nine, but these four have been found by experiment to be the most important. These get phosphorylated. Their tyrosines get phosphorylated. And once they're phosphorylated, they put together a signaling complex involving many components. So I've just shown you three of them here. And we put into our simulations experimental facts that were obtained by doing experiments where tyrosine was mutated to alanine one at a time, and what bound was determined. So we just took those facts and put them into the simulation. These experiments were done by Art Weiss's lab, Larry Samuelson's lab, and Zhang's lab. And roughly speaking, here's the story. PLC gamma, one of the components that actually activates RAS grip, can bind to 132 tyrosine. If 191 is phosphorylated, then GADS can bind to it, and this stabilizes this entire three-body complex. These are just experimental facts that I'm describing. GRAB2 SOS, GRAB2 is what is bound to SOS and attaches to this LAT complex to get it to the membrane. And this guy can bind weakly to all of these tyrosines, very weakly, but if PLC gamma and GADS are both present here, the experiments show that this guy binds very strongly to the 226. Based on what I just told you, you can see that while PLC gamma can be recruited to this membrane by partially phosphorylated LAT, getting GRAB to come efficiently here will require fully phosphorylated LAT because it only binds to 226 strongly when these two are already in place. And this is what this is the simulation result, which shows the number of stably bound SOS molecules to LAT as a function of ligand potency. And you see, to get effective SOS recruitment to the membrane, you need high potency of ligand. But in this range, our simulations show the RAS grip pathway already becomes active because PLC gamma can be recruited by weakly phosphorylated things. The details of this have not been experimentally tested yet. They are being by doing all the right mutation experiments. But one experiment has been done. This is the negative selectors, this one and this one. These are two are the positive selectors. And this is microscopy that Ed's lab has done. You can see that SOS is recruited efficiently to the membrane by the negative selectors, but not the positive selectors. So this indication, maybe we are right in this issue. So in the last couple of minutes, let me say the only relevance of this work, other than it being about RAS signaling to cancers. And here's the thing. So this is what I showed you before, RAS GTP as a function of SOS levels. And this is now increasing RAS grip levels. And you see that as RAS grip level increases, the point of the digital switch moves to lower stimulus levels. And that is for reasons I've already described. It makes the first RAS GTP molecules and so forth. But and ultimately also, as I've shown you, if it's only RAS grip, you will signal in an analog fashion. But look, if RAS grip is overexpressed, which is what we are doing along this axis, something happens, which is that RAS activity becomes very sensitive. Almost constitutive activity of RAS GTP will occur, which is similar to what happens when you have RAS oncogenes, which constitutively maintain large levels of RAS activity. And in fact, in the last year, Kevin Shannon's lab at UCSF and Yaron Roos's lab in UCSF. Some of this they published last year in Nature without us, but that do say that this prediction we made in that paper is maybe true, because they have found human patients as well as mouse models that have increased, have genetically overexpressed RAS grip activity, and these people have T-cell lymphomas, and they don't have RAS oncogenes. They have only the RAS grip overexpression. So we are pursuing this in many different ways. As you know, when you have RAS as an oncogene present, not this RAS grip overexpression, but RAS as an oncogene present, then it's hard to target that as a drug, target that with a drug, because the broken enzyme, what it is that RAS gaps can't act on it to turn them off. So people look at downstream targets, is my understanding. I'm just beginning to learn this. And when you look at either the RAS grip mutations, RAS grip overexpression, or the RAS oncogenes, and you look at downstream signaling, various cell lines containing exactly the same mutation or overexpression of RAS grip, you see completely heterogeneous patterns of signaling. So we're trying to understand this in ways that TACMAC talked about, that if RAS activity becomes too high, you get sensitivity or death, and you get growth for lower levels, and we think the reason for the heterogeneity is simply this. The heterogeneity is there because to get it to some intermediate level of RAS activity and growth and so forth, each cell line makes a different mutation in this complex network, and therefore you see a heterogeneity in reactions. So we are pursuing that. That is there a way to tell what's the given the network, is there a way to tell what's the probability that compensatory mutation is made here or here or here or here? And this is an open-ended problem, and we are at present doing it with toy models. And let me not take you through the details. The toy models are ones where we make many nodes. The nodes are connected to each other. These are the signaling proteins by edges drawn from the distribution of protein-protein interactions. The edges are directed. They have either activation or repressors that sets a topology of this network. There's an output from this network. And then what we're asking is, as you make modulations to this, as you change the topology by mutations, can you end up in different points which are equally fit and therefore will survive? Because that's what you're picking for in T-cell lines and also in people who have cancer. And so we are doing basically Monte Carlo in sequence space, in the space of the topology, to see whether we can predict the probabilities with which you can find different points in fitness space in this. But we have nothing to say at this point about it. It's still going on. And we are, of course, wanting to do it with the real networks that I showed you that we have thought about. So with that, I'll stop. I thank you for your attention.